On this week's 51%, we speak with MOPCO's Kat Coppett about how the tools and techniques of improv theater can build leaders and better workspaces.
Improvisation is the gym for exercising lots and lots of human connection muscles.
We also chat with the award-winning actress and singer Leia Salonga. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. We've got a great pair of interviews for women who are putting the arts to work, literally. Our first guest has built a career on taking the tools and techniques of improvisational theater to businesses around the globe. Kat Coppett is the co-director of the MOPCO Improv Theater in Schenectady, New York, and founder of her own consultancy business called Coppett. For more than 25 years, she has helped organizations and teams work better together by teaching them how to actively listen to one another, how to collaborate, and how to think outside the box. All things, she says, she learned as an improv comedy actor. Coppett first published a book on these tools called Training to Imagine way back in 2001. The third edition recently came out with an updated guide for the modern and semi-remote business landscape. Coppett says leaders and employees alike have plenty to learn from the stage, even if they don't consider themselves comedians or performers. I recently spoke with Coppett about her latest book and why improv produces great leaders.
The new things are three. One is a little more explicit information and guidance for folks who want to be doing activities online. So how to facilitate virtually and adapt. A lot of folks are surprised at how much interactive experiential learning can be done in an online setting. And so I've added those to the exercise section. The book has two sections. So the first part is about the principles of improvisation. And there's a chapter on each one of those skills or muscles that improv can help you exercise. And then the second half is 50 to 100 activities and games sorted by intention or goal with full facilitator guides so that people can do the work on their own. In that section, I've added some work about what the work looks like virtually. I've updated some language. We've gotten a little more savvy about how to be inclusive in the world, even in the last dozen years since the second edition. And then we've updated some examples.
Yeah, so tell me a bit about the connection here. You know, what is it about improv that is so helpful in a business environment?
Really, that's the easiest way to say it. Improvisation is the gym for exercising lots and lots of human connection muscles that 25 years ago, when I wrote the first book, maybe weren't in the zeitgeist. Things like real creative collaboration, creating inclusive environments, celebrating mistakes or failures as gifts that we can learn from and grow from. The most famous improv principle is probably yes and, or put more generically, accept whatever offers are happening in the moment and figure out how to use them and build with them, even if they're not what you like or expect. So improvisers on an improv stage for entertainment or comedy have come up with all of these ways to strengthen these skills of collaboration, listening, building trust, adapting in the moment. But those are skills that we all need as human beings all the time.
Specifically for managers, what does it take to be, I guess, a good leader? And what lessons can they pull from improv training?
So one of the skills that we work on, one of the focuses of the book, is listening. You cannot support people. You cannot figure out what they need. You can't even really give them good guidance or feedback unless you really know how to listen. And that is the superpower of the improviser. So there's some frameworks and lots of activities to help people get to pay attention, not only better, but more broadly, to listen for emotion, to listen for intention, to listen for values, not just information, is a fundamental skill of leaders. Another is presence. We think of status behaviors or presence, charisma, as something that you either have or you don't. But in fact, there's all sorts of ways that we can become more aware of how we're showing up and use that awareness to command credibility and respect and have people trust that they want to follow us as leaders, for example, but also to give respect and status and make people feel valued and respected. And it can be something tiny like making good eye contact or not interrupting or dismissing people, right? Which leaders and managers can do, especially if they're busy.
You mentioned that you've added a few new exercises to the new edition. Give me an idea of what these exercises are like. What can people expect?
So the idea is not to become a performer
Okay.
per se, like on a stage, or to be funny, but we have lots of activities of various kinds, large group activities, activities in pairs, even solo activities that, again, work these skills. So, for example, if we wanted to take this principle of yes and, how do you actually get better at noticing what's happened, really hearing what's happening, and then building with it? So we might do an activity where in a group we tell a story starting each sentence with the words yes and getting very good at, not trying to control or use our own idea only, but to really build with each other and co-create. So that might be one activity. We might use activities to help us exercise our spontaneity and our risk-taking by coming up with t-shirt slogans together or making an ad for a fictional product.
You said the book has solo exercises as well. I think that's a good idea because, personally, I'm a little shy. So speaking up in group activities can be nerve-wracking, even if you're not like explicitly trying to perform or to be funny. I guess, so what kinds of personal exercises can you benefit from?
Well, I think you're pointing to a couple of things, right? We have all these assumptions about what improv is, and I'll say I came to improv not at all thinking I was funny, not, wanting to be wacky at all. And I was an actor, so I get it. And I still have that sort of impulse when I'm a participant in something and someone says, okay, let's do an activity. And I'm like, oh God, no. So I understand what you're saying. I think that there are a couple of things that come to mind when you ask that question. One is we can expand our comfort with discomfort. And so, one of the things we do, whether we're working with individual people one-on-one, helping them as a speaker coach, or whether we're working with a leader on how to feel more comfortable running a meeting with their team, is to help people expand their sort of range of options in terms of how they're showing up and recognizing that it's okay to be uncomfortable, that that's normal, right? Even some of the greatest actors in the world can, say that they have terrible stage fright. So one is just having a tolerance for like, oh, I'm shy and I'm going to share my voice anyway, and turning down the volume on the judgment voices. So that's one thing. But I also think you're right that for some of us, it's really fun to be in a big group and have lots of energy and be playing loud. And for others of us, being able to pause and connect and reflect and then share authentically is what's needed. So part of the activity we do with a group or with an individual is say, how do you make your partner look good by leaving a moment to pause? How do we build in silence and reflection? How do we listen to ourselves as well as listen to others?
This is the third edition of Training to Imagine. Since those earlier editions, I guess, how have you seen the business landscape change?
When I wrote the first edition in 2001, I guess it came out, the publisher was willing to publish the book. They were enthusiastic about it, but they wouldn't even let me put improvisation in the main title. Because they were like, it won't sell. Nobody's going to believe that improv has anything to do with business. And as I said earlier, the skills that we're talking about, the importance of listening, the importance of risk-taking and embracing failure as a path to success and growth, those were very new ideas. The idea of saying yes, finding a reason to say yes and accept and build with what is happening was like the opposite of what smart people did. David Kelly, who started IDEO, the innovation company in Silicon Valley, said he had engineers in his Stanford class, and they really thought that being smart was shooting holes in other people's ideas. Right. So back then, improv was weird, and these principles were new and fresh, and just the ideas really influenced people. That is not true. I think one of the shifts in the third edition is to say, we all know that we have to be able to give and take and want to create an inclusive environment. We all know listening is important. We all know that we want to separate idea generation from idea evaluation. But how do you do that? So, most of the places I go now, that's the difference. They recognize the value of what we're doing. They've even heard, a lot of these things have become cliches. But just like, lifting weights is a cliche, it doesn't mean you still don't have to go to the gym and figure out how to get on a machine.
So how did you get into this? What was your introduction to improv and why did you want to bring it to the business world?
So I was a scripted actor, struggling actor in New York, and I'd gone to acting conservatory and very serious, Shakespearean, Chekhovian actor. And I was in a little theater company, and someone knew someone who was an improviser. They were very separate worlds then, brought them in. And what improv did for me was open a door to how to be more authentic and spontaneous and trust myself in a way that none of my acting teachers ever could. They just would say, oh, you're thinking too much. But they didn't know how to unlock that for me. And so that's how I found improv. I loved it immediately. And when I started teaching it, my students started saying, oh, I wish my boss at work knew this yes and idea. Or, oh, I wish my team at work could collaborate and support each other the way we are doing in class. And you should come teach a workshop for us. And, I was a struggling actor, so I was like, okay, corporations have money, I'll do that. But then very quickly, I said, I don't want to be selling snake oil. I don't really know what I'm doing. Is this valuable for leaders and teams? So I went back and got a master's in organizational psychology and very quickly discovered, oh, most people are starving to be seen and heard and to feel like they can express themselves and connect, not just at work, but certainly at work.
Well, Kat, thanks so much for taking the time. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you want to make sure people know?
I guess the only other thing I might add in terms of your question about what's different, I think first in the pandemic and now again in whatever world we're living in right now, I think people are realizing even more that you can't know what's coming next, right? That we have to be adaptable and flexible and resilient and shift to respond to the unexpected. That's always true. It's always been true, right? Buddhists have known that for 2,600 years. But I think that individuals like you and me are feeling it, are recognizing it in a way that we didn't always. We sort of thought we could control things or we could have expectations. And so that makes people even more enthusiastic and eager for this kind of work. And it feels even more meaningful in the world.
Kat Coppett is the founder of Coppett, co-director of the MOPCO Improv Theater in Schenectady, New York, and the author of Training to Imagine, Improvisational Techniques for Leaders and Educators to Enhance Creativity, Teamwork, and Learning. It's out now through Routledge Publishers. To mark the book's release, Kat will be hosting an interactive launch event running through some of these exercises at MOPCO on January 27th at 6 p.m. You can learn more about Kat's work at coppett.com. Kat, thanks again for taking the time.
Thanks, you, Jesse.
Actress and singer Leah Salonga is in the middle of a long-running tour, bringing classics like I'd Give My Life for You and On My Own to stages around the world. Salonga is known for her roles on stage and in film. Her Broadway credits include Les Miserables, Flower Drum Song, Allegiance, the revival of Once on This Island, Here Lies Love, Stephen Sondheim's Old Friends, and of course, Miss Saigon, for which she won a Tony Award for Best Actress in 1991. She performed the singing voices for Disney's Princess Jasmine in Aladdin and the title character in Mulan. Her most recent album is a holiday record called Sounding Joy. The stage, screen, and everything in between tour brings in songs from many of these works, as well as some of Salonga's other Broadway and pop favorites. Our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds, recently got the chance to speak with Salonga about the tour ahead of a stop in upstate New York.
It's been so much fun performing this program. It's challenging, but also really enjoyable. I leave the stage feeling totally energized and very, very happy to be doing it. So it's just been so much fun being on tour with this.
Yeah, and you talked about picking the music, and that's actually a question I have for you, because you have such a big catalog of songs that you can sing. And
right.
I was wondering, is there certain songs that when you are in that process of picking them that you feel almost obligated that you have to include it because the public will want to hear it?
That's right. Yes, there are things that I feel like, you know, the public has an expectation to hear those songs. So we always include a little bit, you know, not the entire repertoire will be composed of that, because there are so many songs that are just so much fun to sing. You know, folks, I think, tend to want to hear the stuff I've done for Disney. There are songs from certain musicals that people want to get to hear. So I make sure to include at least two or three things, so, you know, that people can expect to listen to during a show.
You've been on tour with stage, screen, and everything in between since September. So I was just wondering, what has that experience been like thus far? Do you have any fun stories, any challenges along the way?
Well, it's always a challenge to, you know, negotiate traveling and doing shows, sometimes doing both in the same day. Those are the times when I'm like, okay, I really have to think about how I'm going to negotiate this show, because I'm feeling less than, you know, optimally energized or rested or whatever. And sometimes when, you know, somebody gets sick on the tour, finding quick replacements is a bit of a challenge. And we've had a little bit of that, but nothing too serious. And, you know, the folks that we have been able to hire to replace as subs have just been stellar as well. So it's nice to know that we have a very deep bench, you know, as far as any of the musicians or whatever. And it's just been an incredible tour. Some of the other challenge that we've recently had to face has been the weather. I did one show in San Diego, and it's at the Rady Shell, which is an outdoor venue. And we were all getting weather reports that, oh, it's going to be raining, it's going to be raining, it's going to be raining. And I come from the Philippines, where rain is not that big of a deal. So I'm like, it's just rain. What's the worst that could happen? The wind. The wind was, you know, the wind is what made it challenging. You know, our musical director was having to use clothespins to keep the music on his piano. And I had to have heaters, one on each side of me, just to try and keep me warm. But because the wind was so strong, it was blowing the warm air behind me. So that was a bit of a bust. And trying to stay warm when the environment is a little on the cooler side. So that was interesting. But the audience all still came, and the colorful rain gear in front of me was worth standing there for. And I think we all had a lot of fun in spite of the weather. And then once the show came down, maybe a few minutes after, then it really dropped, but the rain kind of held. So it was a challenge. And, you know, it's like, all right, we've done it. Let's go home. let's get ourselves back into warmth.
You have been in the entertainment, musical, theater industry since a very, very young age. So
right.
I was curious about your process of developing a character. Has it evolved or changed over time?
Yeah, I'm much more diligent with research now, and really asking questions and not being shy about asking for help. And you know, as a younger person, I think you think you can do everything, or yet you don't need anybody's assistance or research or whatever. But in terms of, for example, playing a character that is very much anchored in a specific historical background, it is extremely helpful to read and to really get on the internet and start looking for clues as to how to play someone, as to what the societal constraints may have been for a particular character. What is the historical context of why this person does this thing, or why that person does that thing? And, you know, how were women perceived in, say, you know, the 1800s in England, or in the United States, or in somewhere in Asia, which will then give a clue to how I can play someone and how to navigate what those challenges are. But yeah, it's definitely evolved. I'm less shy about asking for help now that I'm older. And it's actually fun trying to get as many clues from every department that I'm able to hit up with, whether it's the music department or whether it's a director that I'm working with, or just, you know, getting on the internet on my own and just trying to, you know, to dig up as much information as I can.
Do you have any musical inspirations or influences when you were growing up, or even to this day? Were there certain voices that stood out to you and you aspired to maybe sound like one day?
Yeah, I grew up in the 70s, where a lot of female vocalists were really focused on lyrics. Folks like Karen Carpenter, Olivia Newton-John, like those were the two pop influences that I had. And I had a cousin who would come over, who lived a couple of streets away, and she was much older, and she would come and babysit me, and she would have her guitar with her. And I remember her just playing music on it, and then I would start singing with her. That's where it kind of started. And I would just find myself gravitating towards vocalists who really paid attention to the lyrics of something. So, you know, where the storytelling was really, really important. And as I got older and I started listening to more and more people, and I think as far as musical theater vocalists, Judy Kuhn is one that I just found myself like listening to. And I think the two things that I really remember vividly were her as Cosette in the Broadway cast recording of Les Mis, and hearing her sing someone else's story from Chess, you know. And then later I discovered she was also Pocahontas, the singing voice for that. And anytime I get to hear her sing, she's just spectacular. To this day, she's still incredible. Loved her. I loved watching her in Fun Home. And Days and Days, and watching her sing Days and Days really broke me.
I'm a Broadway mega fan. I love the performing arts. I've been in the performing arts since I was in middle school to this day. And having the opportunity to talk to you, I can't not ask you this. How did you play Kim in Miss Saigon? Because it's one of my favorite cast recordings as well. And that character takes such an emotional journey throughout that two and a half hour show. Portray those emotions. I just wonder, what did you do to prepare for that and to get you to a point where you can do that, but also maintain yourself as well?
I think because I was so young and quite sheltered, all credit goes to my mother. I think that I didn't pay too much. This is a weird thing to say. I didn't pay too much attention to not so much the emotional journey, but, you know, my thing was like, okay, this is the expectation. I think this is what I'm supposed to do. But I really don't have any emotional background in this to do this authentically. I mean, I had not had relationships of the romantic sort, and now I'm expected to play that. So it was a little difficult. So I asked a lot of questions from people regarding, you know, what is it like? What does it feel like to actually fall in love with someone? I don't understand. I don't understand what this character is going through. So I think by the end of the day, the director took it upon himself to demonstrate a few things for me, all in good humor and all with the intention of getting me up to speed in order to portray it authentically or authentically enough. And so I think once he did that, my brain went, why didn't you just do that at the very beginning of this process? And then I would have known what to do. So it's one of those things where, thank goodness, I didn't understand what heartbreak really was. So it made it actually, ironically, so much easier to play. So I think it worked to my advantage that I was so young and inexperienced, that I didn't have any baggage or, you know, romantic relationship trauma. So I was able to just, okay, I'll just do this and go through the motions of doing this. And if it looks real enough for you all out there, then okay, that's it. So yeah, I was able to navigate through all of that and still come out relatively unscathed by the whole thing. So I think being sheltered was much better for me as a human being to then get to play that part.
You will be who you want to be. You can choose whatever heaven grants, as long as you can have your chance. I swear I'll give my life for you.
During your time in the Broadway theater world, you have been a very stark advocate for equal representation. So, you know, I think about the show Here Lies Love, which you mm-hmm. produced and starred in, which had an entirely all-Filipino cast. So I'm just wondering, do you still think there's more work that needs to be done?
Of course. There always is going to be work that needs to be done. There are always going to be setbacks. There are always going to be obstacles. But it only means, you know, that you got to fight harder to get shows that need to be seen by audiences on Broadway to, you know, to get eyes on them. And sometimes the purpose of one show is to provide a stepping stone for another to keep things moving forward. And, you know, having been part of shows with either 100% Asian casts or 90-95% Asian cast has been, it's been quite a challenge. Things like Flower Drum Song, things like Allegiance, but those are worth doing if only to get eyes on us, even for a little bit, in order to get the next show to sort of take that and then lay down a stone for somebody else. And now, fast forward, we've got Maybe Happy Ending, which is enjoying enormous success on Broadway with an entirely Asian company right now. And it's one of the best things that I've seen on Broadway. And it's so beautiful and authentically Korean and, you know, it and relatable and wonderful. And, you know, I'm hoping that more people get to see it. And I hope that it goes on tour so that more people get to see that as an example of authentic storytelling from anywhere in the world, and how that can find footing and success. But there's always still more work to be done. And Asia, being Asia, is incredibly diverse. So I'm hoping for more stories to come out of that world and hopefully find a footing with audiences everywhere.
That was the award-winning actress and singer Leia Salonga speaking with our associate producer Madeline Reynolds. Salonga is on the tail end of her stage, screen, and everything in between world tour. You can learn more about her and her work at leiasalonga.com. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow light. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my